Welcome to the deep dive. You know, if you've ever dealt with back pain, or maybe shoulder stiffness, even chronic headaches, chances are you've encountered someone practicing manual medicine.
That's right. Maybe a chiropractor, an osteopath, a physical therapist, or even a physician specializing in this area.
But the language they use,
yeah,
it can feel incredibly specialized, almost like a code.
It really is.
Yeah.
And that precision is vital when you're dealing with the intricacies of the human body's structure and function. Our source today is actually the definitive glossary from the FUM guidelines for manual medicine.
BFAM.
The International Federation for Manual Musculoskeletal Medicine. And this glossary, it really serves as kind of global roadmap for these non-surgical approaches to what we call the locomotor system.
Okay, so our mission here is pretty clear. Cut through the jargon. We want to help you understand what these practitioners are actually trained to do, what techniques they're using, and maybe most importantly, why they use this specific language.
Exactly. And we should probably clarify right up front that manual medicine, or MM medicine, it's a really broad term. It's a collective.
So not just one thing.
No, it covers physician-led manual and musculoskeletal medicine. Things like osteopathic manipulative medicine, various manual therapy traditions like the approach used in the Russian Federation, for example, and the whole field of arthrokinematics.
Wow. Okay.
But the common thread is that they're all medically regulated non-surgical approaches kind of brought together under this one umbrella term.
Right. So let's start unpacking this. What exactly is the field trying to manage? The core seems to be musculoskeletal medicine, or MSM.
That's the foundation. MSM is the specialty focused on, well, diagnosing, managing, and also preventing functional and structural disorders of the locomotor system.
And that term, locomotor system, you emphasize it. It's more than just bones and muscles, isn't it?
Oh, definitely. It's the whole framework. Yes, the skeleton, the muscles, ligaments, joints.
Hmm.
But crucially, it also includes those parts of the nervous system, even the visceral system, the organs that are associated with or significantly affected by how the muscles and joints are working.
So you can't really treat, say, a knee problem in isolation.
You really can't. Yeah. You have to consider how the nerves supplying that area are firing, how maybe even organ function might be influencing muscle tension around it. It's all connected.
Okay, that makes sense. Which brings us to the main thing these practitioners are looking for. Somatic dysfunction. That sounds technical. Is it basically when something isn't working right, even if an x-ray looks normal?
That's actually a really good way to put it, yes. Somatic dysfunction means impaired or altered function of the body's framework components, the skeleton, joints, muscles, fascia, and all their related blood vessels, lymphatics, and nerves.
So the structure might seem fine on a scan.
Right. The structure could be intact, but the function is off. How it moves, how it feels, its tension is compromised.
And diagnosing this isn't just about looking at an MRI or x-ray then. How does manual medicine diagnosis differ?
Well, it definitely builds on conventional medical diagnosis. You don't throw that away. But it adds these critical layers. First, highly skilled manual assessment, using the hands to feel individual tissues.
Palpation.
Exactly, palpation. Feeling for subtle changes in texture, temperature, mobility, tension. And second, a functional assessment of the entire locomotor system. How does the whole body move together?
And this is all based on science.
Oh, absolutely. It has to be grounded in solid biomechanical and neurophysiological principles. Mm-hmm. It's not just random poking. It's systematic assessment based on understanding how the body should work.
Now, you mentioned they're looking for something specific. The term was reversible somatic dysfunction. Why is reversible such a key word here?
Because it defines the scope, really. Mm-hmm. They're hunting for dysfunctions that can actually respond to manual medicine techniques. Problems where applying these techniques can lead to improved or restored function.
So if it's something like a torn ligament that needs surgery.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Or maybe a neurological disease that needs medication that's not reversible with manual techniques alone. The practitioner recognizes that and refers the patient to the appropriate specialist. It acts as a crucial diagnostic filter. It tells them who they can effectively help with their skill set.
That sets the stage perfectly. If you're trying to restore function, you need to understand the mechanics of movement in detail.
Precisely. Now we get into some of the specialized language around biomechanics. We start with arthrokinematics.
Arthrokinematics, what's that about?
It's the study of the very specific ways the surfaces of a synovial joint, those smooth, cartilage-covered joints like your knee or shoulder, move against each other. The nitty-gritty of joint surface interaction.
Okay, the micro-movements. Does this relate to joint play? I've heard that term.
It does, directly. Joint play refers to those small, passive movements within a joint. Think of roll, Glide, distraction, spin. These are movements you can't do voluntarily with your muscles. They have to be done to the joint.
Like a little bit of slack or give.
Exactly. A healthy joint needs that little bit of inherent play or give to function smoothly through its full range.
Mm.
If a joint loses its play, it feels stiff, restricted. That's often a key sign of that somatic dysfunction we mentioned.
Fascinating. And speaking of specific, maybe even tiny movements, the source material mentions the sacrum, those minimal motions, nutation and counternutation.
Ah, yes, the sacrum's subtle dance. These movements are really small. We're talking like half a degree to maybe 1.5 degrees. Tiny.
So what are they? Nutation.
Nutation is when the top part of the sacrum, the base, nods slightly forwards and downwards relative to the pelvic bones. Counternutation is the opposite. The base tilts backwards and upwards.
Why does such a tiny movement even matter?
Well, even though the movement itself is minimal, assessing the quality of that movement, is it symmetrical?
Right.
Is there resistance? Can tell a practitioner a lot about functional issues in the low back and pelvis. It's diagnostically very significant.
Okay, so we have structures that aren't moving quite right, but pain isn't just mechanical, is it? The nervous system must be involved.
Absolutely central. This is where we pivot to the neurological side of things, starting with articular neurology.
Neurology of the joints.
Essentially, yes. It's the branch of neurology studying the nerve supply to the joint systems, the capsules, ligaments, etc. But the really mind-bending phenomenon, the one that explains so much about pain in this context, is convergence.
Convergence. Okay. Walk us through why that's so important.
What happens is that incoming nerve signals, called afferents, carrying information from different tissues, say from a joint capsule, a nearby muscle, maybe even the overlying skin or an internal organ.
They all funnel together.
They converge, yes. They all synapse or connect onto the same neurons in the dorsal horn of the spinal cord. That's the first major processing station for sensory information.
And this is where that special neuron comes in, the multi-receptive dorsal horn neuron.
Exactly. Also known as the WDR neuron, which stands for wide dynamic range, or sometimes the spinothalamic projection neuron. These are mostly found in a specific layer of the spinal cord gray matter called lamina V.
Think of it like a busy intersection.
A very busy switchboard is a good analogy. This single neuron gets the first summary of information coming in simultaneously from joints, muscles, skin, and internal organs, the viscera.
That sounds like it could get confusing fast. Why is this WDR neuron such a big deal for understanding pain?
Because it fundamentally muddies the waters for the brain. If that WDR neuron is getting bombarded with danger signals, maybe from a stiff joint and a tight muscle, at the same time, the brain struggles to pinpoint the exact source.
So it might misinterpret where the pain is coming from.
Precisely. It might perceive the pain as coming mostly from the muscle, even if the joint is the primary issue, or vice versa. Or it might feel pain in a completely different area altogether that's the basis of referred pain.
Okay.
And it highlights why a practitioner needs to be so careful in their diagnosis. Is this back pain really coming from the spine, or is it referred from, say, a kidney issue? That WDR neuron convergence is why.
And manual techniques might try to influence this neuron.
That's often a key goal. By providing strong, non-threatening mechanical input, like movement or pressure practitioners, try to essentially flood the switchboard with positive signals, potentially overriding or dampening down those pain signals before they ascend to the brain.
That makes perfect sense. And it leads us right into the techniques they use. We absolutely have to clarify the difference between manipulation and mobilization. There seems to be some global confusion there.
There really is, and the glossary aims to standardize this. In many places, particularly following the FIME European standards, the term manipulation is used exclusively for one specific technique.
Which one?
The high velocity, low amplitude technique, or HVLA. This is the classic thrust technique. It involves a very rapid controlled movement, but over a very small distance, delivered right at the very end of the joint's available passive range of motion.
The one people often associate with a pop or crack.
That's the one, yes. And a crucial part of setting it up safely is pre-tensioning carefully, taking the joint up to that end range barrier just before the quick thrust is applied.
Okay, so HVLA is often called manipulation in Europe. What about mobilization?
Mobilization has a much more consistent definition globally. It refers to low-velocity, passive techniques. Think slower, often oscillatory or rhythmic movements applied within the joint's normal physiological range of motion.
So no quick thrust, more like gentle stretching or rocking.
Exactly. It's about encouraging movement within the existing range, maybe gently pushing into the restriction but without that high-speed thrust at the end range. Mobilization is generally considered gentler.
Okay, clear distinction. HVLA manipulation versus slower mobilization. What about other approaches, like using needles?
Right, that brings us to dry needling. This involves inserting fine filament needles like acupuncture needles directly into muscle tissue.
But it's not acupuncture.
Not in the traditional sense. The goal here is very specific, to target and release those tight, irritable knots in muscles known as myofascial trigger points. The needle acts as a mechanical stimulus, causing a microtrauma that helps the contracted muscle fibers relax. It's about the physical effect on the trigger point.
Got it. And then there are neuromuscular techniques, NMTs. The name suggests they involve the nerves and muscles somehow.
That's exactly right. NMTs are a group of techniques that cleverly use the patient's own nervous system reflexes to help relax muscles and improve range of motion.
How do they do that?
Well, they might incorporate mobilization, but add a component where the patient actively participates. For example, using the contraction of the opposite muscle group to inhibit the tight muscle that's called reciprocal inhibition.
Okay.
Or, perhaps more commonly, having the patient gently contract the tight muscle against resistance for a few seconds and then fully relax. That brief contraction followed by relaxation often allows the muscle to stretch further. That's post-isometric relaxation, or PIR.
So you're kind of tricking the nervous system into letting the muscle go.
That's a great way to think about it, leveraging physiological reflexes to achieve a therapeutic outcome.
What if the practitioner is just using their hands directly on the muscles and fascia pressing, stretching, kneading?
That falls under the broad category of soft tissue treatment techniques. This includes a whole range of approaches like direct pressure, lateral or linear stretching of muscle or fascia, myofascial release techniques, which focus specifically on the connective tissue layers, deep pressure, and traction.
And they're feeling the tissue the whole time.
Constantly monitoring the tissue response through palpation, yes. Adjusting the pressure, direction, and duration based on how the tissue feels and releases under their hands.
Finally, in terms of approaches, we have osteopathic manipulative medicine, OMM, and its application, OMT. What's the core idea there? Is it different?
OMT, osteopathic manipulative treatment, is defined as the therapeutic use of manually guided forces.
Yeah.
So using the hands to improve physiological function and/or support the body's natural tendency toward health, its homeostasis, particularly when it's been altered by that somatic dysfunction we talked about.
And it's guided by a specific philosophy.
It is. OMT is grounded in four core osteopathic principles, which honestly underpin much of manual medicine thinking more broadly.
Can you remind us what those are?
Sure. First, the human being is a dynamic unit of function. Mind, body, spirit are interconnected. Second, the body has inherent self-regulatory and self-healing mechanisms.
Okay, the body can heal itself.
Right. Third, structure and function are reciprocally interrelated at all levels. How something is built affects how it works, and how it works affects how it's built or maintained.
Makes sense.
And fourth, rational treatment is based upon an understanding and application of the first three principles. So when an osteopathic physician uses OMT, they're aiming to remove restrictions, structure, to allow the body's inherent healing capacity function to take over.
That reliance on the body's own systems brings up a critical point, safety. If you're applying these specific forces, especially HVLA, safety must be paramount.
Absolutely non-negotiable. The glossary is very clear on contraindications. These are specific circumstances or conditions where a particular technique absolutely should not be used because the risk of harm outweighs any potential benefit.
Like certain types of instability or bone disease.
Exactly. Or bleeding disorders, certain neurological signs, recent trauma. There's a whole list depending on the technique and the body area. An adverse event or complication is defined as harm actually occurring due to the treatment. Rigorous screening is essential to avoid these.
And is there a way to test the waters before doing something like a thrust?
Yes, that's where trial mobilization or trial tensioning comes in. It's essentially a safety check.
How does it work?
Before applying the full therapeutic force, or especially an HVLA thrust, the practitioner might perform a gentle, preliminary version of the movement or apply the pre-thrust tension just to gauge the patient's response.
Looking for pain or guarding.
Precisely. Does it increase pain? Does the patient react negatively? Does the tissue feel like it's resisting excessively? It's a mini test designed to predict if the full technique might cause an adverse reaction. It's a crucial step in risk management.
Okay, let's loop back to the pain signal itself. We talked about the WDR neuron as the processor in the spinal cord, but where does the danger signal start?
It originates from what's called a nosti generator.
No psi generator. Sounds like where the noxious signal is generated.
Exactly. It's any anatomical region that contains those specialized nerve endings, often C fibers, that detect potential or actual tissue damage, inflammation, or other threats. They send the initial alert signal to the central nervous system.
So the NOCI generator is like the smoke detector sensing the fire.
Perfect analogy.
Mm-hmm.
And if the NOCI generator is the detector, then the body's entire complex response to that signal involving changes in the connective tissue, the sympathetic nervous system, hormones, muscle activity, even spinal cord, and brain processing, that whole cascade is termed the NOCI reaction.
The whole body responding to the alarm.
Right. But sometimes, as you said, that alarm system becomes faulty. It gets too sensitive. That's sensitization.
What happens during sensitization?
Essentially, the neurons involved, either the first ones detecting the signal, peripheral sensitization,
mm-hmm.
or the second ones in the spinal cord, like the WDR neuron, central sensitization, become hyperexcitable.
Easier to trigger.
Much easier. Their receptive fields might enlarge, meaning they respond to stimuli over a wider area, and their threshold for firing drops significantly. Clinically, this leads to hyperalgesia.
Which is?
An exaggerated pain response to something that should only be mildly painful, or even pain from stimuli that shouldn't be painful at all, which is called allodynia. The system is amplifying the danger signal.
Practitioners also need to differentiate between specific sore spots, right? The glossary mentions myofascial trigger points versus tender points. They sound similar.
They can feel similar initially, but there's a key diagnostic difference. A myofascial trigger point is that hyper-irritable spot located within a taut band of skeletal muscle. It's painful when you press on it, and this is crucial. It can produce characteristic referred pain.
Pain felt elsewhere.
Yes, often in a predictable pattern distant from the trigger point itself. It might also cause referred tenderness, motor dysfunction, or even autonomic phenomena like sweating or goosebumps in the referral zone. These are the points targeted by dry needling or specific manual release techniques.
Okay, so trigger points refer pain. What about tender points?
A tender point is also a small, hypersensitive area in myofascial tissue, painful on compression. However, it does not have that characteristic pattern of pain radiation. The pain stays localized right where you press.
And they're used differently.
Yes. Tender points are often used more diagnostically, perhaps as markers for conditions like fibromyalgia or to monitor progress. While they indicate sensitivity, they don't necessarily have the same referred pain component or taut band structure as a classic trigger point. The treatment approach might differ too.
Good distinction. We should also quickly note a term used in some European countries, painful minor intervertebral dysfunction. What does that describe?
It's essentially a diagnostic label for a painful reversible dysfunction specifically located at a spinal joint segment. The important part is that this dysfunction is understood to cause a cluster of reflex reactions in the tissues innervated by that same spinal segment.
Which is called?
The segmental celluloperiosteal myalgic syndrome. It's a mouthful.
It certainly is.
But it just breaks down the affected tissues. Cellulo refers to changes in the skin and subcutaneous tissue, periosteal to tenderness on the bone surface, and myalgic to muscle tightness or pain, all within that segment. It really emphasizes that interconnectedness, again, the joint problem affecting the surrounding skin, bone lining, and muscle via reflexes.
Okay, fascinating. Now, for our final section, let's shift gears to the people doing this work. How are they trained? We need to talk about education and global standards, especially within that European Bologna framework. There are two main models mentioned, capacity model and component model.
Right. This is about ensuring quality and consistency in training across different countries and systems. The capacity model describes a situation where manual medicine is treated as a defined subspecialty added onto an existing primary medical qualification.
Like a doctor becoming specialized.
Exactly. Someone might qualify first as, say, a family physician or an orthopedic surgeon, and then undertake significant additional postgraduate training and assessment specifically in manual medicine to gain that capacity.
So it's an advanced specialization. What's the component model?
In the component model, manual medicine training is integrated directly into the main curriculum of a relevant medical specialty right from the start. For instance, a musculoskeletal medicine residency program might have manual medicine woven throughout its training structure as a core component.
Why is this distinction important for, say, a patient or someone learning about the field?
It's really about ensuring standards. When an organization like FAM sets standards, they need to account for these different pathways. The goal is that whether someone trained via the capacity route or the component route, they achieve a comparable high level of competence. especially regarding diagnostic skill and the safe application of techniques like HVLA. It helps create a globally recognized standard of practice.
And quality is formally recognized through accreditation and certification, right?
Correct. Accreditation is the process applied to the institution or the training program itself. It's formal recognition that the program meets established quality standards set by an authority like FAM or a national body.
So the school or program is accredited?
Yes. Certification, on the other hand, applies to the individual practitioner. It's the official proof, the piece of paper, confirming that they have personally met the required educational standards and demonstrated the necessary competencies.
Competencies. That leads nicely to the final point on education. The difference between competency-based education and structure and process-based education.
This is a really significant philosophical shift happening in a lot of professional training, not just medicine. Structure and process-based education is the traditional model. It focuses heavily on the inputs and the process.
Like how many hours you spent in class.
Exactly. How many hours, how many credits earned, maybe 300 hours of coursework and 30 ECTS credits, for example. It defines success by participation in the structure.
And competency-based education, how is that different?
It flips the focus entirely to the outcomes. What can the learner actually do as a result of the training? It emphasizes the observable demonstration of ability integrating the knowledge, the practical skills, and the professional attitudes needed for safe and effective practice.
So it's less about seat time and more about proving you can actually perform the task.
Precisely. Can you accurately diagnose somatic dysfunction? Can you safely perform an HVLA manipulation when appropriate? Can you communicate effectively with the patient? The focus is on demonstrating measurable competence, which many argue is a much better way to ensure high standards in a practical, hands-on field like manual medicine.
This has been an incredibly detailed journey through the specialized language. We've gone from tiny sacral movements through the complexities of spinal cord neurons like the WDR.
All the way to differentiating HVLA thrusts from gentle mobilizations and understanding the global standards for training the practitioners who use these techniques.
It really paints a picture of a sophisticated discipline. It requires not just deep anatomical and physiological knowledge, but real mastery of specific hands-on skills and a constant focus on safety checks like trial mobilization.
Absolutely. It's far more than just cracking backs. It's a nuanced field grounded in biomechanics and neurology.
So stepping back, what's the final thought for you, the listener, maybe as someone who receives these treatments? What's the fundamental link between the practitioner's touch and the changes happening in your body?
Well, that really brings us down to the cellular level, to a fundamental biological process called mechanotransduction.
Mechanotransduction. That's a big word. Break it down for us.
Simply put, mechanotransduction is how living cells convert a mechanical force or stimulus, like the pressure from a mobilization, the stretch during myofascial release, or even the micro-impact of dry needling into a chemical response within the cell.
So the physical force triggers a chemical change.
Exactly. The physical stress or strain on the cell membrane, the cytoskeleton, the extracellular matrix, it triggers intracellular signaling pathways. This can influence things like inflammation, tissue repair, gene expression, pain modulation, basically the cell's behavior.
So think about that. How does that cell-level conversion, that mechanotransduction, potentially impact your overall health and the function of your structure? When a skilled practitioner applies a specific manual technique,
they aren't just passively moving a bone or stretching a muscle. They're initiating a cascade of biological signals starting right at the cellular level. These signals can then influence tissue healing, reduce inflammation, modulate nerve activity,
and ultimately support those inherent self-regulatory and self-healing mechanisms we talked about with the osteopathic principles.
Precisely. The physical intervention becomes a form of biological communication. It really underscores that dynamic unity of structure and function, operating constantly, right down to our very cells.